This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Of Sea and Shadow, written by Will White, performed by Travis Baldry.
Welcome, listener. Right now, you're listening to the first book in the Elder Empire series, but it's not the only first book. Of Sea and Shadow was written in parallel to Of Shadow and Sea, which tells a related story in the same world. These first two books were written as a pair, and their stories intertwine in a way that we think you'll enjoy. We invite you, when you're through with this book, to check out Of Shadow and Sea. Until then, welcome to the Elder Empire. Chapter 1. Present Day. Calder Martin stood on the deck of his ship, sailing into the wall of black clouds and rain. He clamped his hat down, holding it tight against the slashing grip of the storm.
"We go against the wind, Andal," Calder shouted. "The sails are coming down."
Next to him, Quartermaster Andal Patronus clutched his own hat and glanced up at the sails.
"Are you waiting for applause, sir?"
"I do prefer an audience."
Calder gripped the wheel, reading the intent bound into the wood. His mind flowed through the bones of the ship, sensing every inch of the testament as though it were his own body. He sent a simple, silent order to his soul-bound vessel. Behind him, the sails furled. They looked more like a bat's wings than ordinary canvas sheets. The testament's sails were stretches of membranous green skin that seemed to grow from the mast and yard. When they folded, the ship resembled a nightworm diving from the skies. As the ship began to slow, Calder sent another mental command. Instead of gliding to a halt, the vessel continued moving, jerking forward a few dozen yards at a stretch, almost as though they were being pulled along by a giant.
"Is my wife secure?"
The quartermaster shook his head.
"I'm afraid she's dead, sir. A fever took her in the night."
Calder spared a glance from the upcoming storm wall to catch a look at Andal's face. Andal Patronus was a Heartlander, dark-skinned, and his white suit stood out against the wood of the deck. The man, as usual, wore no expression. He pressed his hat down with one hand and clung to the railing with the other.
"One day you're really going to have bad news for me, Andal."
"Then I'll try to smile, so you know something's wrong."
The man in white strode off across the deck, shouting orders.
"Raise the thunderlights! Ready the cannons!"
Calder silently persuaded the ship to release its four captives. Thunderlights, huge alchemical lanterns with copper spikes that unfolded almost as high as the mast. Thick ropes hauled the devices out of the hold through a hatch on deck, until a glass lantern big enough to contain a man rested on the four corners of the ship. The lines tightened themselves, tying the thunderlights to the deck, but Andal had to release the copper spike by hand. Calder only controlled the testament, not its cargo. As the first drops of rain began to slap the ship, Andal turned a crank on the lantern, slowly raising a copper limb into the sky. An Imperial navigator could sail the Aeon Sea with almost no crew thanks to the captain's command over the ship, but Calder couldn't handle everything. The storm was a dark slice of night in front of them now, flashing with lightning. As the ship slammed down into a valley between two waves, sending spray spilling over the deck, Calder looked to his gunner. Dalton Foster straddled one of the cannons, a hammer in one hand and an alchemist's spray bottle in the other. He was leaning out over the railing, his head practically stuck inside the cannon's mouth.
"How are the guns coming, Foster?"
Calder shouted. Foster pulled his head out and turned. His wild hair and beard were soaked through until he looked like a cat that had escaped the bath. He tore one pair of spectacles off, letting them dangle from a cord around his neck, and lifted a second pair to his eyes.
"That depends, Captain. Do you want to hit our quarry, or do you want a face full of shrapnel when the cannon explodes?
Must I choose, or can I have it all?"
Calder squinted up through the rain, scanning the dark clouds. The Chimera they hunted wasn't particularly dangerous on its own, but it only flew during lightning storms. They'd been tracking this one for weeks, and if it got away this time, he might decide to mutiny against himself. Those thunderlights had cost him 100 gold marks apiece. Andal finished setting the lights, their copper poles stabbing into the storm. Normally, they would never risk themselves by sailing into a storm like this, but those copper rods were invested to attract lightning. Calder had read them himself, checking and strengthening their intent. He only hoped they would work soon, so he didn't have to spend any more time in this weather than necessary. As the thought occurred to him, a spear of lightning stabbed one of the copper spikes. There came a blinding flash from the starboard thunderlight, and then the liquid in the glass container ignited, glowing with the yellow light of a cheery summer noon. In essence, thunderlights worked the same as the quick lamps that lit every home and shop in the capital. They were glass bulbs filled with alchemical formula that produced bright, steady light. But unlike quick lamps, which glowed for a few years and had to be replaced, these thunderlights would work as long as they had lightning to recharge them. They were essential equipment for any navigator that meant to hunt storm wings. But Calder was missing something more critical, namely, his prey. A storm wing should show itself on the storm wall, drifting over the tops of the choppy waves, but the Testament was still charging through air thick with rain, all with no sight of the Chimera. Calder was about to call for more drastic measures, but then a song drifted over the detonations of thunder and the crash of water against the hull. It sounded something like a pod of whales singing in chorus, somehow keeping harmony with the percussion of the storm.
"Port side, Andal!"
Calder shouted as the stormwing blasted through a wave. He caught sight of it in flight. The Chimera soared over their ship, a line of pure white lightning with wings of shadow stretching off to the sides. It sang in triumph and exultation as it passed, its volume piercing through the storm. The wheel fought him as he forced the ship to starboard, lining up with the stormwing as it vanished behind a wave. A detonation of light marked the creature's passage, sending up a towering spray. Andal's white suit was already soaked through, but he didn't let that affect his dignity as he marched across the deck.
"We have clear line of sight, Mr. Foster. Load the red shot."
Foster clung to the cannon like a monkey to a tree branch, furiously working on something that Calder couldn't make out through the rain.
"What do you think I'm trying to do, huh? You think I've picked just this moment to polish the iron?"
The quartermaster's response remained as even as ever.
"I don't care what you're polishing. I need a red ball loaded right now."
The storm wing passed in front, and by the creature's own light, Calder caught a better look. It resembled a manta ray the size of their ship, with a rippling luminescence rolling up the tip of its tail and all the way through its spine. It glided on the wind, lashing the peak of a wave with its tail. A flash of light exploded from the point of contact, sending up another plume of water. Calder leaned forward, trying to angle his three-cornered hat so that it kept more water out of his eyes. It didn't help. A second bolt of lightning lit up the thunderlight on the bow, giving them a better glimpse of the storm wing as it vanished behind another wave. He shoved the wheel to one side, sliding over the wave in the Chimera's wake.
"Where's that shot, Foster?"
Foster shouted something that was swallowed up by the thunder, jamming a red ball into the cannon. He fumbled around as Calder tried to keep the ship as steady as possible, working as much through reading and his intent as through any manipulation of the wheel. Finally, a flare of light came from the back of the cannon as the fuse lit. The gunner yelled in triumph, hauling his weapon around to point at the storm-chopped horizon. At that moment, the storm wing blasted up from the waves, exposing its belly to the ship, the core of its body glowing. It howled a song of victory. Calder forced his intent down into the wood.
"Hold steady."
But there was nothing the ship could do against the forces of nature. The Testament began to slip down the other side of a wave. When the cannon fired, its shot tore a strip of skin from the edge of the Chimera's wing instead of taking the creature in the head. Red shot, a special ammunition used by Chimera hunters, was designed by the Alchemist's Guild to prevent the powerful creatures from striking back when injured or dying. Simple tranquilizers would work against some creatures, but stormwings were among those Chimera breeds that managed to escape as soon as they felt the sting of the shot. They would dive beneath the waves to flee from the pain. With that in mind, a round of red shot was actually a hollow ball containing an alchemical paralytic, tranquilizer, and hallucinogen. The compound was designed to work in concert, confusing and subduing the stormwing before putting it to sleep. In its confusion, the creature would settle down and float on the surface of the waves to get its bearings. The paralytic meant it couldn't get far, and as it rested, the tranquilizer would have its time to set in. Calder and his crew would catch the Chimera in their invested steel nets, hauling it back to port to sell fresh. But if the shot wasn't a direct hit, the whole plan died a fiery death. Now they had a confused, pain-enraged, hallucinating monster striking at them with a tail that caused explosions, and they had to fight it in the middle of a storm. If they made it back to port, drinks were on Foster. The Stormwing screamed, lashing its tail at the ship. The deck exploded in a blinding flash of light, sending splinters, torn rope, and one of the spare cannons hurtling into the storm. Calder felt the broken wood like a physical pain, and through the smoking hole he could see a slice of his hold. He couldn't help worrying about his wife. She was supposed to be in a different part of the ship, but what if fate was unkind and she had found herself impaled on a piece of debris? Then again, he was relieved that the Stormwing strike hadn't shattered any of the thunderlights. They had enough to worry about without adding an alchemically fueled fire on top of everything else. Foster clung to the back of his cannon, trying to swing it around for a clear shot as the Stormwing banked around for another pass, screaming and thrashing its deadly tail in the air. Andal hurried over to the hole in the deck, kneeling and gazing into the hold as though he could fix it in the middle of the storm.
"Look what it's doing to my ship!" Andal shouted.
As he watched the Stormwing come back around, Calder realized that he was wasting his time. If they kept at it, they would be flopping around until they got in a lucky shot or the Chimera tore them apart. He abandoned the wheel, hopping down to stand beside Andal. He unbuttoned his sleeve, rolling it up to the elbow. It was time for extreme measures. Calder knelt next to his quartermaster. "Pardon me, Andal, but this is my ship." Then he pressed his palm to the deck and read the ship. Visions flashed through his mind. Calder nails one plank to another, begging them to stick. Calder's mother places her own hands on the wood, persuading them to repel water. He called on the bond between him and the testament, and the bond between the ship and something far older. A six-fingered hand rose up from the ocean. The hand, webbed, dark blue, and big enough to rip the belly out of the ship, lifted out of the waves like a sunken tower cresting the surface. Dull, algae-spotted metal encircled the wrist, a manacle made of enough iron to recast every cannon on board. Links of chain, each thicker than an anchor, trailed from the creature's arm to vanish in the dark water beneath the testament. Reaching up from the storm-tossed surface, the giant hand seized the Stormwing's tail, jerking the Chimera to a halt in the air. The Stormwing screamed, thrashing and beating its wings, turning in on itself to sink its fangs into the scaled hand. From the shadows beneath the testament, a cloud of bubbles boiled up. A hiss of pain sliced through the storm, and the arm flexed. It whipped the Stormwing against the water with a crack more deafening than the thunder. Water lifted in a rolling wave away from the impact, a wall of the ocean rising for them.
"Brace yourselves!"
Calder shouted, and the quartermaster echoed him. Calder dove for the lines, wrapping himself in fistfuls of coarse rope. When he saw Foster still scrambling to control the loose cannon, he sent a simple mental signal to the ship. Ropes snaked over to Foster, grabbing him by the wrists and ankles and holding him fast.
"Light and life protect us,"
Calder muttered to himself as the wave loomed over them. A weight settled on his right shoulder as if a cat had suddenly landed there. Something tickled his cheek, and a deep baritone echoed him.
"Protect us,"
it chuckled. Calder turned to glare at the creature perched on his shoulder. It was a squat little monster with a dark green, leathery hide and stubby bat wings. Its eyes were solid black orbs, its mouth hidden behind a mass of squirming tentacles.
"Shuffles, what are you—"
Then the icy water of the Aeon Sea crashed down on them both. Darkness and cold rushed over Calder in a rush of sound. The water clawed at his body, trying to pull him out and away. His wrists burned where the ropes cut into him, but he didn't dare loosen his grasp. By the time the waves subsided, Calder was untangling himself from the lines, hurrying back to the wheel, coughing out mouthfuls of seawater. Shuffles rode along on his shoulder, chuckling to itself. The Stormwing was still alive, but it wouldn't be for long. Its wings were pinched between giant fingers, and it struggled uselessly to escape. As the Chimera writhed, a true monster rose from beneath the Testament. Both of its arms were bound in shackles connected to the bottom of Calder's ship, but the rest of its body was unbound. It stood like a man, with a row of ridges running down its spine like sails. Its head belonged to a predatory fish, though it bore three black eyes on either side of its face. It drew the Stormwing closer as though to get a better look at its meal. The Chimera still struggled, but the towering monster's grip was unbreakable. The blue lips parted, revealing a mouth full of shark's teeth. It hissed, a sound sharper than a knife's blade, and gills flapped on either side of its neck. Then the Leviathan, the elder bound to the bottom of the Testament, tore its prey apart. One wing came off in each hand, spattering the ship's deck with droplets of shining yellow blood. Calder's heart sank as Foster fought his way free of the lines, sending a futile kick at his own cannon.
You couldn't wait! You could not wait one more second for me to line up another shot!
Calder sent his intent through the ship, running down the invested chains to the Leviathan itself. The elder was old beyond imagining, but it did tend to listen to its captor, most of the time. Into his reading, Calder poured his need for the Stormwing, his desperation to bring back something to sell, and his determination to extract the Chimera's precious fluid. Usually that worked, though sometimes he had to throw in a bribe. Andal walked below deck, presumably to check on the rest of the crew, but Foster was still going.
Now we're locked in the middle of a storm with nothing to show for it, and we won't find another one this late in the—
He was cut off when the severed tail and spine of the Stormwing landed on the deck, leaking glowing yellow-white fluid. It was long enough that it crossed the Testament from stem to stern and bright enough to drown out the illumination of the thunderlights. Calder heaved a sigh and let his whole weight rest against the wheel.
Foster, get Petal and Urziah up here. We need to preserve as much as possible.
Foster marched down the ladder.
Petal! Woodsman! Get your buckets and get on deck before I make you bleed!
Shuffles chuckled in Calder's ear, tentacles waving.
Bleed?
Calder ignored it. The bellowing horror liked to imitate the most disturbing words it heard, but the creature was harmless. He treated the thing like a parrot. It didn't look like they'd get the full payoff they'd hoped for, but they could probably retain 60 or 70% of the Stormwing's luminous liquid. Two-thirds of a fortune was still a fortune. The Alchemist's Guild would pay in hundreds of gold marks for vials of the stuff. He grinned, placing his hat back on his head, and bowed in the Leviathan's direction. The giant was settling beneath the waves, hissing as it disappeared under the water.
Disconcerting and reassuring at the same time.
As Sedesthenes said, the worst enemies make the best allies. Calder wasn't sure he could count the Leviathan as an ally exactly, but certainly as an asset. It had agreed to serve him for a short time, but a short time to the ancient being could extend into the lives of Calder's grandchildren. He turned the wheel, sending his intent down, and the Leviathan obediently dragged the ship along, away from the flashes of lightning. After weeks of chasing this Chimera, they could leave storms behind them, and Calder had never looked so forward to sunshine. Boots pounded back up the ladder, and Urziah Woodsman appeared, a bucket dangling from each of his huge hands. He gave his gap-toothed smile when he emerged, staring up into the rain. He closed one eye, but the other, a glass replacement, stared blankly upward.
I never get tired of the rain, not even when the rain comes every day.
Well, I do, Calder called down. We're heading out to smoother seas.
That is a shame. The monsters here are much bigger.
Petal slid out behind Urziah without a word, her frizzy hair hiding her face. She sank to the deck beside the severed Stormwing spine, crooning as she milked glowing liquid into her bucket. Calder didn't bother saying anything. When the ship's alchemist was lost in her own world, no human speech could get her attention. The next person on deck was a surprise. His wife, Jirene Tasella Martin. Jerry wore a bright green raincoat that matched her emerald earrings. Bracelets flashed on her wrists as she hurriedly pulled her hair back, tucking it under her waterproof hood. Her wide, eager smile instantly worried him. It had taken him days of pleading to get her to stay below during the confrontation with the Chimera. There was nothing she could do to help, and the more people they had on deck, the greater the risk. She had agreed, but she wasn't happy about it. If she was smiling now, that meant she had found something more interesting than two monsters fighting. She rushed up to him, pecking him on the cheek and wrapping him in tanned arms. Alarm bells sounded in his head.
You would not believe what I found down in the hold.
Her eyes sparkled as though she had heard wonderful news. Calder leaned back, examining her expression from arm's length.
What did you find?
She pulled on his wrist, tugging him away from the wheel.
You'll have to come see.
The last time she'd had a surprise for him, it had ended up being a clawed elder spawn that he'd been forced to nail to the inside of the hull.
Should I bring my pistol?
Only if you plan on shooting Andal, which I would support. It's not a monster this time, but I could have sworn it was impossible. Maybe a reader could tell me how they did it.
That was too intriguing to pass up, so he let her guide him down into the belly of the ship. The hold had been packed with barrels, crates, and packets of gear, though most of the space was unoccupied. They had planned to return with a new load of cargo after all. Now, raindrops and thin rivers of stormwing fluid flowed in from the fractured deck above through the hole that the Chimera had blasted. Some of the crates had cracked open, leaking salt or wine, and a loose barrel rolled around on the wood. Calder sopped the wild barrel with one foot, looking around for anything unusual. Jirene picked up a quick lamp, shook it, and raised it to one side. In the splash of yellow light, Calder saw a message burned into the inside of the hull, as though someone had scorched a letter onto his ship. Thin wisps of smoke still rose from the charred wood. Calder kicked the barrel aside, walking up to examine the lettering.
Paddle didn't do this?
I came in here after the explosion to check the damage, and I saw it being written. It burned itself into the wood as though someone was writing with an invisible pen.
She clapped her hands eagerly, like a child at a show.
Now read it.
He did, his own excitement growing by the word. Calder, hope this mysterious message finds you well. I just learned how to do this, and it's going to blow the pants off certain people back in the capital. If you see it first, show it to Jirene. She appreciates a touch of theater. The guild has a new client. A pair of witnesses wants you to take them to a particular island to pick up some relic. This could be huge, Calder. Not just for you, but for the Empire. And for the Emperor. Calder stopped reading for a moment, shooting a glance at his wife. The Emperor? Jerry's smile widened.
Keep reading. It gets better.
Whatever else this letter said, the Emperor had been dead for over 5 years. What did the witnesses hope to find on the island? A way to bring him back from the dead? Considering they were talking about the Emperor, they might be able to do it. That was a disturbing thought. And by the way, this will be big for you. This chronicler was in charge of finance in the Imperial Palace. He wants me to tell you that if you're successful, you will sleep under sheets of golden silk in the cabin of your flagship at the head of your brand new fleet. His words. So, I suggest you get your leaky tub and your flea-bitten crew back to port before he comes to his senses and hires somebody else. Cheska. Captain Cheska Bennett, head of the Navigators Guild, was prone to exaggeration. But if she'd taken the effort to burn an entire letter into the wood of his ship to get his attention, then this must be big. And if the reward was half as generous as promised. He felt his mouth go dry. Sedesthenes once said, "The wise man is not blinded by gold, but only a fool turns it down." Calder rushed back up to the deck, Jerry following close behind him.
"Andal, I'm raising the sails. I find myself suddenly homesick."
Chapter 2. Everyone has intent, even you. You use your intent every day. When you use a pillow to sleep, a brush to straighten your hair, or a coat to protect you from the wind. you are lending some of your intent to an object. Over time, your intent builds and builds, helping that item get even better at doing its job. You will fall asleep faster on your pillow, your brush will never snag, and your coat will stay warm year-round. What an amazing world we live in. From Chapter 1 of the best-selling children's guide, Reading About Readers. 13 years ago. Calder walked through the wood-paneled halls, over carpets soft as an owl's whisper, and tried to look bored. He moved his eyes past an urn with delicate gold filigree worked into the edges as though he took in such sights every day.
100 silver marks, he guessed.
Then he spotted a collection of pocket watches hung on the wall and arranged in a tasteful display.
At least 50 silver marks apiece, maybe a gold mark for the frame.
The snarling head of a chimera, something like a lion with a mane of sterling silver, mounted over the coat rack.
100 gold marks? More? Who could you hire to stuff a chimera anyway? Is that legal?
Altogether, the house positively reeked of money. Walking beside him, Calder's father adjusted his fake glasses and blew out a fake mustache. He was trying to appear nonchalant, but Calder could all but feel his excitement. Their host, Mr. Carls Dunwood, led them to a spacious office walled in polished logs meant to evoke a hunting lodge. A stonework hearth against one wall enhanced the effect, and an array of more stuffed heads, black bears, 12-point bucks, and what seemed to be a young nightworm, completed the impression. Mr. Dunwood had a seat at his desk and gestured for his two guests to do the same. He had to use his left hand, as his right had been replaced by a blunt silver hook. An accident at sea, they'd been told.
Before we begin, can I offer you anything by way of refreshment? Mr. Dunwood asked, his smile revealing several gold teeth. I received 6 bottles of the Shift Apple 96 from Nathaniel Boreas himself. You'll never taste finer, I assure you.
Calder's father, Roderick, chuckled politely.
Perhaps if my son weren't with me, then I would accept, but he's a bit too young. It would be rude of me to exclude him so.
Their host gave Calder a gold-speckled grimace.
He is more than welcome to wait outside. Business meetings are no place for children, I've found.
This was all according to plan, and Calder had rehearsed his part. He drew himself up, indignant.
Excuse me, I am 12 years old, and I have been attending such meetings with my father since I was 9 and a half. We are partners in this endeavor, sir.
Mr. Dunwood laughed, trying to appear amused, but he rubbed the base of his silver hook with his one remaining hand. His eyes shifted between the two of them. They had selected their appearance carefully. 2 matching blue suits, immaculately tailored. Their red hair was slicked back with grease in precisely the same manner, and they sat with the same affected posture. After trying once to get the child out of the room, Mr. Dunwood would realize that he could not break up the pair and continue while ignoring Calder as much as possible. That was the plan. And indeed, matters proceeded as they expected.
Of course, sirs, he said. I would not hope to separate the noble family of Fair Street.
Fair Street was the name of an alley through which they had happened to pass a few weeks earlier.
It's unusual, I know, Roderick allowed. But where else would I send him? His mother, may her soul fly free, was taken by drink. I did what I could to save her from her fate, but when one is set on the road to self-destruction, alas, her liver failed her only 2 winters past. If he does not learn the family business, then where is he to go?
Calder's mother lived not an hour's walk from this very building. He could barely remember her face. Mr. Dunwood bowed his head solemnly.
Fate can be cruel, but let us not linger too long on the past. The future concerns us today, is it not so?
Roderick smiled beneath his orange mustache.
It is indeed, Mr. Dunwood. I have a buyer who is willing to secure the future for all of us if you can produce what you claim. Pending the verification of a reader, of course.
I have taken the liberty of securing such verification myself, in fact. The document will be provided along with the object itself.
Calder shifted in his seat, letting his posture slacken, resuming his facade of boredom. He was actually scanning the decorative firearms mounted on racks behind Mr. Dunwood's head.
50 silver marks, 60 silver marks, 35 silver marks.
Roderick cleared his throat and glanced from side to side as though checking for observers in this windowless room.
Regarding the object, sir, would you be so kind?
Dipping his hook into his jacket pocket, Mr. Dunwood withdrew a ring of keys. After fumbling one-handed at the metal for a moment, he found what he was looking for and leaned under his desk. Surreptitiously, Calder brushed his hand against the heavy wood of the desk.
The tree is a little girl's favorite hiding place. She tucks her toys into its roots where her brothers will never find them. The lumber is solid, sturdy. The laborer thinks it will go to a fortress wall, maybe, or a vault door. The carpenter places his hands on the desk, feeling the wood. He's finished bolting metal plates to the inside of the wood. It has enough armor to stop a pistol shot and stands more than sturdy enough to hold a safe.
It took longer to sort through the impressions left in the desk than it had to read them. This desk was not terribly significant. It hadn't been through any momentous events, at least none that had made their mark in its wood, but it was invested with enough intent to reinforce the grain, keeping it sturdy and solid. It would be hard to saw through and steal the safe, much easier to take the key.
Good thing that's the plan, then.
From somewhere beneath the desk, a safe door squeaked open, and Mr. Dunwood withdrew a polished wooden box. He placed it carefully on the surface of the desk, as though it contained an explosive that would be set off by the slightest wrong movement.
Gentlemen, Mr. Dunwood said in a reverent whisper, I give you the oldest imperial artifact not currently in the Emperor's possession.
With the tips of his fingers, he levered open the lid of the box, revealing an old, ragged quill pen. The feather itself must once have been beautiful, as a lustrous rainbow sheen still clung to the pen like a thin slick of oil. But the intervening years had worn it down until the feather looked sickly, bedraggled, more like a relic of a strangled chicken than a chimera quill pen wielded by the Emperor himself. Roderick gave a low whistle.
I can practically see the weight of age. 500 years, you say?
You have a good eye, Mr. Fairstreet. Yes, I had my reader dated back at least that far. The Emperor used it to pen the documents that led to the end of the Scullery Wars.
Truly a triumph of the Empire.
Calder's father rubbed his hands eagerly.
Well, whatever the provenance of this item, I can tell that you have some impressive contacts, Mr. Dunwood. Where, for instance, did you manage to procure the head of a nightworm?
Mr. Dunwood shifted to look behind him at the black-scaled, draconic head baring its teeth from the wall. He grew a proud smile as he started to launch into his story. Calder's moment had come. He hopped up, snatching the pen from its case as soon as Dunwood's attention was distracted.
It doesn't look like much, he said.
The Wind Watcher glides through the sky, eyeing the currents that shift like rivers of blue smoke through the sky. It nudges an updraft of hot air closer, and the wind obeys, bending the warm column toward the chimera. The Wind Watcher catches the draft in its wings, letting the wind lift it higher. It needs all the help it can get, for its passengers are heavy and want nothing more than speed. The craftsman works at the end of the feather with his penknife, desperate not to make a mistake. This quill should never spill ink, never smudge or break. It has to write flawlessly, smoothly. For all he knows, his life might depend on it. The Emperor sighs, holding his quill over the inkwell. A servant girl rushes forward, rubbing his shoulders, and he leaves her to it. Tonight, he should relax. With one letter, he could condemn a group of merchants to poverty and probable starvation. With another, he might damn his loyal servants to execution. He needs to be eloquent now to phrase the perfect message that will save them both. Or else he might be tempted to kill them all and let Kellerak sort out their souls.
The visions faded as Mr. Dunwood grabbed the pen back, red-faced.
This is priceless. What do you think you are doing? How do we know it's real?
Calder replied automatically, his mind still swirling in a spiral of intent.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Dunwood, Roderick apologized. He's been an Elderspawned nightmare since his mother passed, that I can tell you.
Mr. Dunwood replaced the pen in its case as though lowering an infant into its cradle.
Then why don't we let him be someone else's nightmare for a time, hmm?
Roderick sighed.
Would you wait outside for me for a while, son?
Calder huffed and marched out, slamming the door for good measure. It was hard to stay in character while still in the grip of a reader's trance, but he kept it up until he was safely away. Then he slumped into a chair, gasping for breath, trying to separate his own thoughts from his alias, from an ancient craftsman, from the Emperor. At least they had their answer. The artifact was real. Roderick followed his son out only a few minutes later, wearing a broad smile.
We finalized the sale. A bit more than I was hoping for, but he negotiates like Kellarak himself.
The second reference to Kellarak, the collector of souls, almost sent Calder spiraling back into the trance. He shook off the visions, following his father out of the building. Only when they were gone did Roderick mutter,
"It was real then."
Calder grinned. Later that night, Calder and his father returned, but without the props. They were dressed in the simple clothes and apron they had stolen from a local delivery company, and they carried empty boxes over their shoulders. If they were caught, they could claim that they had brought a late-night package that required a signature and had found the door unlocked. They wouldn't be caught, though. This was the capital, the city that night could not conquer. No one would notice a couple of deliverymen and their packages. Roderick set his crate down with a huff, knuckling his back as if he'd been freed of a great load. His mustache and glasses were gone, his red hair loose and hidden behind a cap. Calder had adopted the bulk of the disguise this time, having dyed his hair black and slipped a bandage over his left eye like an eye patch. He put down his own burden, a box of flowers, and placed a hand to the door. Nothing but a faint echo. The door held no intent or significance enough to bother them.
No traps on the door, he whispered.
His father jiggled the doorknob as if testing it. His left hand slipped into his pocket and pulled out the greatest treasure they'd ever found. An old, dented, corroded copper key. He palmed it, tapping it once against the knob. Instantly, Calder heard the tumblers unlock. The door swung open.
Must want us to leave it inside,
Roderick said aloud for the benefit of any eavesdropping passers-by. At night, the house was less impressive and more frightening. The mounted heads seemed to be trying to shoulder their way through the walls to get Calder. The guns on their racks pointed straight at him, their muzzles yawning like bottomless pits. All that Calder noticed with half his mind, while the rest was focused on all the riches they were leaving behind. They had a schedule to keep, so they were passing up the 50 gold mark urns and 100 silver mark watches, though they could easily stuff enough into their flower box to sustain them for a year. But the quill could put them in silk suits and cigars for a decade. They rushed to the back office, where another tap of the key let them right in. The ordinary-looking copper key was the only genuine imperial artifact they'd located up to this point, and the only bounty they'd kept for themselves. It was too valuable to sell, Calder's father had said, and Calder believed him. When they reached down for the safe, they found it already empty, the door hanging open. That was when Calder knew they were finished. He bolted for the door while his father stepped up to the wall as though trying to find the quill's new hiding place. Both of them were too late. A squad of monsters marched through the door. One of the men looked ordinary, except for his arms, which were covered in fur like a bear's. Claws tipped each of his fingers. Another, a woman, grabbed Roderick and forced him against the desk. She hissed in his face, revealing fangs like a snake's. A parade of horrors spread out over the room, a display of human and chimera melding. One of the men lashed a tail, while another stared straight at Calder with the two wide eyes of a giant owl. That was when Calder realized what they all had in common. They wore the same red and black pressed uniform, tailored to meet their unique anatomical requirements and marked with a crest. The crest stood proudly on the breast of each uniform, the size of a man's spread hand. It was a golden shield bearing the imperial seal, a crescent moon tucked inside a blazing sun representing the breadth of the empire. "My dominion shall stretch from the sun to the moon," the emperor had once said, and he had proven himself right. Only one guild had the right to bear the seal, and if the Imperial Guard were here, that meant the game was well and truly over. As everyone in the capital knew, no one escaped the Emperor's guard. When the guardsmen had Roderick secure, with his arms tied behind his back and a pistol to his head, one of them let out an unnaturally high whistle. On cue, their leader entered the room. He looked like a strict grandfather, bone thin, with only a brush of white hair on his head and the pinched look of someone who consumed food only as fuel for his body. He wore his Imperial Guard uniform as though it had been glued to his skin. A set of gills rode on either side of his neck, flapping in the air.
"Mr. Martin," the guardsman said, nodding to Roderick. "Master Martin," he nodded to Calder. "I am Watch Leader Fitch. You are hereby under arrest for attempting to purchase the stolen personal property of the Emperor."
It did not escape Calder's notice that the Watch Leader had not called them Fair Street. Roderick panted in the chair where the guardsman had shoved him, glancing around the room and soaking himself in sweat.
"You have to understand, we thought it was a Windwatcher feather. There's a big market for them overseas. We had no idea the Emperor had ever touched it."
Fitch flourished a piece of paper, gills flaring.
"That's not what this bill of sale says. We received it from Mr. Dunwood not an hour ago." "A bill of sale?" Roderick repeated, incredulous.
Calder gaped. "Who wrote out a bill of sale for stolen goods?"
"Carls Dunwood is not the greatest criminal mastermind the Empire has ever seen," Fitch said dryly.
Roderick changed tactic.
"What about Mr. Dunwood?"
He latched onto the name like a drowning man to a log.
"Get him in here, and I'm sure we can straighten all this out."
Watch Leader Fitch reached up to the mantelpiece and pulled down a pocket watch, popping it open.
"I extracted a penalty from Mr. Dunwood once before, on the understanding that I never hear from him again. I do not repeat myself."
From somewhere outside, a shout rose, followed by a pistol shot. Fitch snapped the watch closed.
"Right on time. Now, Mr. and Master Martin, you must have built up quite a bit of information to make it this far. I will have the names of your confederates from you, and then you will be incarcerated in the Candle Bay Imperial Prison for the foreseeable future."
Roderick lunged forward, grabbing his son by the shoulders as if to protect him.
"He's too young for chains. Please, you can't take him."
The Imperial guards pulled Roderick back without any trouble, but not before Calder felt a slight weight drop from his father's hand into his own shirt pocket. Watch Leader Fitch remained expressionless.
"I have come to a different arrangement regarding the boy. Rest assured that he will remain secure."
Roderick didn't look assured by that at all, any more than Calder felt. He could sense walls closing in around him, penning him in. Were they going to send him to an orphanage? He'd heard horror stories about such places all his life, how the children were abused and then sold to black alchemists for experiments. Would he ever see his father again? Calder felt tears welling up at the corners of his eyes, and he decided to use them to his advantage.
"Please, Mr. Fitch,"
he said, looking up at the Watch Leader with wet eyes.
"Please don't take him away. This can be a warning."
Roderick closed his eyes. Fitch, by contrast, looked absolutely unchanged.
"The last time I let someone off with a warning, it cost him his hand, and he still didn't change his ways. Now, I'm afraid you must be searched."
Two guardsmen marched Roderick out of the room.
"Please, don't take my son! Don't take my son!"
The door shut behind them, leaving Calder alone with the rest. Watch Leader Fitch's gills flared.
"You too, boy. Off with your clothes."
Calder obeyed, unbuttoning his shirt. He pretended to fumble at the second button, working at it hard enough to tear. All so he could keep his hand close to his shirt pocket. He could feel the significance of the key through the fabric, but he focused on the pocket around it, silently chanting,
"Hide it, hide it, hide it, hide it."
Calder bent his will entirely on concealment, focusing his intent like a scalpel. He moved his fingers down to the next button while still concentrating on the weight of the key through his shirt. He imagined the guards overlooking the pocket and the key inside it.
Hide it, hide it, hide it.
When he stripped down to his undershorts, shivering more out of awkwardness than cold, the man with the bare arms patted him down, checking for alchemist-created pockets of fake skin. It felt like having a dog walk up and down his sides. Meanwhile, the owl-eyed man ruffled through his clothing, calling out everything he found.
Small knife. Delivery order to this address. A small river stone, possibly invested.
His hands moved to the bundled-up shirt, and Calder made his sniffles louder, trying to draw attention away from the shirt.
Nothing else, the guard declared. We'll need to get a reader to check it all out, of course.
I suspect his new guardian will take care of that, Fitch said.
Go on, boy, put your clothes back on. If there's nothing suspicious about your belongings, they'll be returned to you at your new address.
A fresh wave of tears struck him through the shivers, and these were anything but fake.
Where am I going?
Fitch placed a hand on his back and guided him over to his pile of clothes.
To your mother.
Chapter 3. Present Day. Repairing the testament was a relatively simple matter, involving nothing more than 300 planks of purchased wood and an afternoon of Calder's attention. Once he set the boards where he wanted them, he invested them as part of the ship, reading the hole to make sure that the ship accepted its new addition. When he had finished nailing the boards more or less in place, he rested his fingers against the deck and sent a command to his soul-bound vessel. The testament grew together, merging its deck with the new planks into a seamless whole. The new patch was a slightly lighter color, but otherwise indistinguishable from the rest, or the other repairs Calder had made over the years. His work done, Calder leaned back against the deck, massaging a nascent headache. He hadn't pushed himself into a full-blown case of reader burn, not yet, but he still felt like someone was throwing bricks at the back of his head. Andal stood over him in his white suit, surveying the deck.
It makes one wonder how ordinary captains repair their ships.
I shudder to imagine the expense.
Thanks to a captain's control over his ship, a navigator's crew was incredibly small. This was one of the reasons why the Guild remained the only force capable of crossing the Aeon Sea at will, and why its navigators tended to amass huge personal fortunes. One of the reasons. Ignoring his aching head, Calder pushed himself to his feet.
Since you're here, I imagine we've heard from Cheska's mysterious passenger.
Andal handed him a folded sheet of paper.
You might say that.
Prepare to receive us at sundown, the paper read. We depart at dawn. Calder tried to look into the paper's past, not just reading its words, but reading the intent behind them, but he got nothing more than faint wisps of emotion. Not surprising. Such a small slip of paper would not have retained much intent, especially for an innocuous note. But you never knew what reading might show you. He winced as his headache increased. Even an unsuccessful reading put a strain on him.
I guess he wants to spend the night on the ship.
Why wouldn't you? Clever company, romantic atmosphere, the lingering aroma of dead Stormwing.
Did you get this straight from the source?
From Cheska's messenger. The girl with the evil eye.
Andal rubbed his silver amulet as if for luck. It was carved with the white sun crest of the Luminian Order. Some believed that wearing such a symbol would bring the blessing and protection of the unknown god. Of course, the amulet hadn't landed Andal anywhere better than a ship exiled to the Aeon.
So, we still don't know anything about our mysterious witnesses?
Calder placed his three-cornered hat back on, gazing out over the Candle Bay Harbor. The water was busy this time of year, with navigators, merchants, and fishermen jockeying for position along the docks. Calder had many memories of this place, and most of them still showed up in his nightmares. Andal tossed a loose nail into the bay.
They didn't tell us how many passengers to expect.
Knowing witnesses? Almost certainly two.
Nor were they very specific about our pay.
If it was enough to catch Cheska's attention, it will be enough for us.
I'm not certain I can return the crew in time.
Nevertheless, he didn't seem like he was in any particular hurry. Jerry's visiting her mother, which means she'll come back furious within the hour. You'll find Urzaya in the closest establishment that will serve him a drink, Foster at the gunsmith up the hill, and Petal? If Petal's left this ship, I'll commission that life-size statue of yourself you've always wanted. In gold.
I've always pictured myself in marble.
Still, Andal didn't move. At last, Calder sighed and turned to face his quartermaster.
Mr. Patronus, what seems to be the problem?
Andal drummed his fingers on the rail, eyes shadowed by the wide brim of his hat.
I know you remember what happened last time Cheska Bennett promised us an unusually large reward.
Calder tried not to.
She did pay us. Was it worth it? If you had known what you were signing up for, would you have agreed, even for 500 gold marks?
He liked to think that he would do anything for 500 gold marks, but the truth was that he didn't know. Cheska's last assignment had almost killed him. It had been worse for Jerry. We're not working for her this time, Calder said with confidence. It's a real, legitimate guild mission for an independent client, and it could be for much more than 500 gold marks.
I don't get out of bed for could be, and I would never agree to a voyage sight unseen.
I haven't agreed yet. Andal fixed him with dark eyes.
Haven't you?
Calder's gaze traveled past the bay, up a hill to the west, and into the sprawling imperial capital. This could be a moot point very soon, Andal.
Why is that, sir?
Because if I'm not mistaken, that's our client. Down at the docks, two people moved against the crowd. A man in a bright red suit strode in front, with his wavy hair blowing in the breeze. The figure that followed him stood out even more. Calder thought it was a woman, wrapped in bandages like a body prepared for burial. Wisps of black hair stuck out of the bandages over her head, and she wore an overcoat two or three sizes too large for her. In one hand, she carried a gilded wooden case, and the other arm was wrapped around a full-sized traveler's case. The man had his eyes locked on the testament, a confident smile on his face. Andal adjusted his hat to block out the setting sun.
What makes you think that's them?
Because they're the only two people in the crowd strange enough to be hiring a navigator for a mysterious sudden mission. The quartermaster let out a breath.
I'll gather the crew. But consider walking away, Calder. At least consider it.
Then Andal left, brushing past the two strangers on his way down the ramp and across the dock. Calder took up his position at the top of the ramp, wearing his best smile. He bowed, sweeping the hat from his head.
Lady and gentlemen, honored members of the Guild of Witnesses, please let me be the first to welcome you aboard the Testament. I am Captain Calder Martin.
The man in the red suit extended one hand, and Calder took it.
Naberius Claiborne, guild chronicler and one-time keeper of the Imperial Palace Treasury. This is my silent one, Tristania. Are you familiar with the traditions of my guild?
Calder smoothly relieved the woman in bandages of her large suitcase, setting it to the side. She was carrying a smaller case as well, but when he tried to take that one, she bowed and stepped to the side.
I was fortunate enough to have witnesses as tutors in my youth, Calder responded. Though one brother never spoke, he managed to deliver his lessons nonetheless.
Naberius smiled as though he were trying to show off each one of his teeth.
You will find much the same here. Justania is no tutor, but she does make herself perfectly clear without speech.
From Calder's past experience with witnesses, the chronicler would be a reader of impressive skill and the silent one a warrior and bodyguard. Though Tristania bowed politely and kept her eyes lowered through the gap in her bandages, Calder had not a single doubt that she carried weapons in that coat of hers. The chronicler, Naberius, looked like an actor hired to play an ancient imperial hero. His dark brown hair rolled down to his shoulders in rippling waves, and his bright red suit, while eye-catching, was high quality and closely tailored. Naberius clapped his hands together.
Now, would you kindly show us to our cabin?
Assuming I'll take the job.
He wondered what Cheska had said to them. He wouldn't be surprised to hear she had accepted on his behalf.
I don't mean to be disrespectful, Mr. Claiborne, but I wonder if I could hear a few more details about the voyage first.
The silent one widened her eyes in surprise, turning to Naberius. For his part, Nabarius adopted a look of exaggerated shock.
Did Captain Bennett not tell you? I should have realized. Forgive me. She didn't strike me as the type to see her work through to the end.
One did not rise to become the head of an imperial guild by leaving work unfinished. Cheska would shirk almost anything else, but she took her job seriously. He imagined the look on her face if she had heard Nabarius' opinion of her, and the thought brought him a warm smile.
You are an excellent judge of character, sir, he said.
As I have said, I was the chronicler in charge of financial records in the Imperial Palace. Since the Emperor's death, may his soul fly free, my partner and I were the only ones remaining with the knowledge to access the treasury. We have used those resources for a few essential tasks, keeping the capital running, funding the Imperial Guard, the list goes on. But soon, that will not be enough.
The chronicler's smile broadened.
The Emperor's personal finances were much more interesting than simple piles of silver marks and gold marks. They included the location of several items of value, including, you might say, buried treasure.
Calder's eyes filled with visions of ancient chests packed to overflowing with Azirian gold coins. He took an involuntary step closer, suddenly much more interested in the story. I'm sorry if this seems rude, but do you have a treasure map? Nabarius tapped the side of his head.
It's more accurate to say that I am a map. Now, I know that you and your crew are not treasure hunters.
Let's not rush to any conclusions.
Well, Captain Bennett recommended several crews in your guild that were more experienced in the detection and removal of valuable items, but that wasn't the crew I asked for. I asked for a ship crewed by those who could handle themselves in dangerous situations. She directed me to you.
The fool seeks out combat while the wise man stays at home. One of the most well-known sayings of Sedesthenes. Calder found himself in fights depressingly often, but he prided himself on never seeking them out. Except when he had to. There were always exceptions. You expect dangerous situations to arise, then.
I find myself prepared for the possibility. And for 10,000 gold marks, I believe that you should be prepared as well.
Calder's smile stuck. He couldn't seem to wipe it off. Quickly, he ran through the math. For day-to-day expenses, most people dealt in marks. For larger purchases, they could use silver marks, and for monumental investments, like hiring a navigator to sail across the Aeon, the prices were often measured in gold marks. 10,000 gold marks meant 1,000,000 marks. Once, Calder had fallen into debt to the Emperor in an amount that was supposed to last the rest of his life. That debt had since been cleared, both by his own efforts and by the Emperor's death, but this single voyage could have covered what he owed twice over. Cheska hadn't exaggerated. He really could buy his own fleet.
He coughed, then continued. If you have a heading, I have a ship.
Dalton Foster shoved his way up the ramp and past them, seeming not to see their passengers. He held a lumpy sack over one shoulder, and his mane of gray hair stuck up in all directions. Two pairs of spectacles hung from cords around his neck, and he squinted forward in the sunlight.
A crew member of yours?
Nabarius asked, sounding amused. My gunner. Don't worry about him. He doesn't care where we go. Calder raised his voice to address Foster.
Andal found you?
The old man sat down cross-legged on the deck, swiveling a cannon around to face him until he could shove his head in its mouth.
He cost me a deal on a Tadoria 66. I expect compensation.
Calder turned his smile back to the witnesses.
See? He's eager to serve you.
Nabarius peered around the deck.
I was told your wife would be traveling with us. Surely you would like to consult with her.
She is visiting her family, actually, which means I should be able to see her.
Calder turned to the west, to the crowd at the docks, until he spotted a woman in a simple blue dress pushing through the others as though each and every person had offended her.
Right now. She'll be here in a moment. Until then, shall I show you to your cabin?
He heaved their luggage onto his shoulder, taking them to the furnished cabin at the stern. It was designed to be the captain's, but whenever Calder had a passenger, he preferred to give them the room. Generosity pays off when the final bill comes due. That was Hester, not Sedesthenes, but true nonetheless. Navarius stood a head over Calder, and he had to lean down to look inside.
Very cozy. Truly better accommodations than I expected from a navigator's vessel. But this is where you sleep, isn't it?
Some passengers liked to make a show of reluctance before they accepted.
For this voyage, it's where you sleep.
Navarius shared a glance with a bandaged Tristania, who dipped her head and walked back to the ship's bow.
I appreciate your generosity, but we have not spent our entire lives in the capital.
He gestured for Calder to bring their luggage back out.
While we are here, you may treat us as cargo. Take us where you and your wife were planning to stay.
If they really wanted to ride like cargo, they'd be down in the hold, but Calder said nothing. Instead, with many a protest that they were more than welcome to take the cabin, Calder led them to the space beneath the bow. In the original plans for the Testament, this space was designed to hold extra supplies. The boards were so low that Navarius was bent over almost in half, and there were no amenities except two rolled-up hammocks and a candle next to a box of matches.
Charming. We'll take it.
A little reluctantly, Calder set the luggage down between the two hammocks. He couldn't help but wonder why they were turning down the cabin. Would this be an excuse to skimp on their payment? How much money was this going to cost him? But they had made themselves clear, so he bowed to the both of them.
As you wish, Mr. Claiborne. Navarius, please.
He stuck out a hand, and when Calder shook it, he found a paper crumpled up within. On further inspection, it seemed to be a crisp, yellow-printed bill. A gold mark. Maybe they wouldn't skim money from the contract after all. Jirene marched up to the deck now, eyes still burning from the meeting with her family, but she smiled when she saw the passengers.
These must be the guests Jessica sent us. Have you come to an agreement?
10,000 gold marks, Calder said.
She curtsied politely. How very generous of you both.
And he suspects there might be danger. Her smile grew wider, and the anger vanished from her eyes.
Gentlemen, gentle lady, welcome aboard the Testament. How may I serve you?
That night, when everyone had returned to the ship, Calder introduced his crew. Now that the sun had set, they had all gathered around a quick lamp on the deck, eating roast quail and spiced chickpeas. This might be the only decent meal they had for the next 2 months, so Urzaya had stretched himself.
First, let me introduce the man who crafts all the meals we will enjoy on board the Testament, Urzaya Woodsman.
Urzaya rose to his full height and thrust both fists in the air, as though he had been called to fight in the arena. He had pulled his blonde hair back into a tail today, and his broad smile held a few gaps where teeth had been knocked loose. His sun-tanned skin bore a network of scars, and he wore patches of fabric all over as though he sliced up all his clothes before wearing them. A stretch of golden hide wrapped around his right arm, and dull snakeskin covered his left. A worn leather breastplate protected his chest below a woolen scarf that must have been unbearable in the heat. He wore his pants underneath a patchwork kilt straight out of an Aranin legend. Even his boots didn't match.
Every meat we eat on board,